From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our Project Milwaukee series on the high rate of incarceration among black men in Wisconsin continues with a story on local efforts to help former inmates find gainful employment once they return to their communities. Then we'll learn about the appeal of seeing Milwaukee's lakefront by boat, traveling at 4 to 5 miles an hour, just like the first Westerners to visit our shores.
That was the speed of life back then, and the top speed of life back then, and it really is a contrast between the past and the present.
An exhibit features handicrafts commissioned in Wisconsin to create work during the Great Depression. And a young self-taught photographer finds his greatest inspiration in his hometown.
I guess you could say I want people to, you know, look at my photos and feel like this is a city I want to live in. This is Milwaukee.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Our Project Milwaukee series on the high rate of incarceration among black men in Milwaukee is nearing its conclusion, and the focus has moved to solutions, ways to break the cycle of prison. A key issue many have talked about is employment. At the same time so many African-American men have served time in prison, the number of jobs in the inner city has dwindled. And while some state-sponsored programs allow inmates to leave prison with skills, there's no guarantee of employment, and often a prison record is an insurmountable obstacle, leaving ex-offenders with few legal options to support themselves or their families. But there are organizations and companies trying to turn the tide. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke visited a facility that serves a small but growing number of ex-offenders who are challenged to find meaningful employment.
The building looks like any one of 1,000 old industrial plants on Milwaukee's north side, places that were once bustling with activity as the city thrived in the 1940s and 50s, but has been in decline ever since. But the sense of idleness outside the red brick structure belies the scene inside. That's where you'll find Leroy Macklin at work on a computer.
We sell CDs, DVDs, VHSs, books, games, video games, different variety of things, tools. Also, we just got into tools. Things to help us, like I said, keep our top-selling rank up.
That's a top-selling ranking on Amazon. Macklin is one of the longest-tenured employees of Milwaukee Working, an organization that helps former inmates and some others develop a solid work history. Milwaukee Working is in a number of industries. Selling donated merchandise is a fast-growing part of its portfolio.
When a product come in, either it's a DVD, CD, I clean it, refurbish it, make it brand new. But when I list it on Amazon, I describe it to the best of my knowledge. But even though the CD might come out brand new or anything, I still say that it still got scuffles on it. I under-describe it. So once they get it, they see, oh, it's practically like new.
Macklin says that customer satisfaction is behind the top seller rating they've earned. It's a far cry from where he might have expected himself to be at this point. Much of his early life was spent amid drugs and violence on Milwaukee streets, but he says two things set him on a different path: 10 months in jail and the responsibilities of parenthood.
My oldest son, who's 8, going on 9 now, he kept looking at me. I'm looking at him like, Daddy, we're going to the block. I got tired of hearing that. As me calling myself a grown man, I decided I got really procure and, you know, stand out for my son. So now that I'm here, faithfully come to work every day, I try not to miss no days, but been here faithfully every day. My kids really like that. They like coming here working with me.
Macklin was one of the original 4 employees hired by Milwaukee Working when it opened as an offshoot of the nonprofit Community Warehouse in 2010. Nearly 20 people work jobs there now. CEO Bob Wolf says the goal is not to develop lifelong employees. Rather, it's to give people work experience that will make them more attractive to private industry.
You know, there is a real fear and, frankly, a risk that private sector companies have to take by hiring someone from background challenges. For us, we look at it as more of, hey, there are times we understand there's issues. We're going to set aside some time to help them overcome them. If we don't, they may they may never overcome them.
For many former inmates, the issues are more than just learning a marketable skill to bring to a new employer. They're learning about life skills that enable them to navigate everything from the medical system to finding their next job. That's why the converted dairy plant not only has production space, but also a brightly lit common area with comfortable chairs, tables, and computer stations.
What's great is if they need to talk about something, they can come up the stairs, come in the resource center for a half an hour, and then go right back to work. And it really makes it, otherwise they'd have to go off-site, right? Who knows how long it would take? They'd have to track it down. There's transportation issues, many other things that come into play that would take their time away from work.
In addition to the online Amazon marketplace, Milwaukee Working operates a wood shop and cabinet making facility and an electronics disassembly and recycling center. Employees learn skills from driving a forklift to using a nail gun to working with specialized saws to build doors, vanities, and kitchen cabinets. Bob Gunn manages the wood shop and says he couldn't be more pleased with his employees.
They're so eager, they want to learn as much as they possibly can. And they're here on time. They make a 100% effort on what they're doing. They're extremely respectful. They give you basically everything that they possibly can. Their heart is in it, and that's the whole thing.
But sometimes they do mess up. Bob Wolf says they've had issues with reliability, though employees are not fired for occasional slip-ups. He says the long-time employees play an important role in setting new hires on the right path, and Leroy Macklin agrees.
Guys know I've been through what they've been through or what they're going through, so I try to be help. Actually, guys ask me to be their mentor. I try to, you know, even motivate them, you know, to do the right thing. So, like, if I have trouble, I have questions or need somebody to talk to, I can go to people that have been here longer than me. Like I said, the guys, wonderful team leads. Just like the guys look at me and they come to me, talk to me about anything.
They also come to Chris Lesko. The Brookfield woman is one of the volunteers in the resource center, sometimes helping write resumes, sometimes just listening and talking employees through their problems. She says she isn't bothered by the criminal records of the people she works with.
No, that hasn't really affected my decision to come here at all. In fact, if anything, it makes me want to understand more, you know, what's going on in their lives. And just the joy of seeing them turn their lives around is huge. And it really just motivates you to want to help more people be able to turn their lives around.
The building itself is still a work in progress. Milwaukee Working strives to operate under a self-sustaining business model. But it's also helped through the support of funders such as the Helen Bader Foundation. Program officer Jerry Roberts sees a metaphor in the transformation of the once dilapidated factory.
It takes an abandoned building. You take some folks who, in essence, have been abandoned by the system, by society, and kind of dismissed, like this building had been, and it transforms that.
For his part, Leroy Macklin shudders to think what his life might look like without his job.
If I didn't have this, I'd be steady in the street. Thank God I'm still here. I'm still living. Unfortunately, I might would have been dead or in jail.
And for Macklin, that's as good as a top seller rating on Amazon. For Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke in Milwaukee.
You'll find more from our Project Milwaukee series at wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. It's time for Milwaukee Magazine's annual City Guide, and we'll have a preview of it when Lake Effect returns. You're listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. From various points in the Milwaukee Public Radio offices, you can see both Lake Michigan and the Milwaukee River. And we're pleased to say that neither of them is iced over this morning. In fact, the sightseeing season is well underway on both bodies of water. Milwaukee Magazine paid special attention to seeing the city from the water in their current issue, their annual city guide. Managing editor Tim McCormick and senior editor Howie Magner both contributed to the feature. They joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio, and McCormick talked about how they approached the task.
Well, after the winter we had here in Milwaukee, we kind of got to brainstorming about the City Guide issue, and we thought, let's focus on the great outdoors. I think at that point we had had a record amount of days where the thermometer never got above freezing. And at this point, you know, it's that cold and we got to start thinking City Guide. And so we thought, let's focus on the great outdoors. Milwaukee has a bunch of great waterways.
It was nice to think about water that wasn't frozen.
Yeah. Well, right. This is, I'm sure, a calculated risk you talk that there would be no ice by the time this
yeah,
system came
I mean,
out.
It was risk, I think, you know, when they had to
June.
Take the photos and everything
yes,
for the
yeah.
cover.
Well, and Tim, your article gets at ways of seeing the Milwaukee area by water, and presumably most of these places were unavailable at the time you were compiling this.
I think Howie had the same issue, too. A lot of these people are snowbirds and seem to get out of town here during our inclement weather. But a lot of them were more than happy once we did connect with each other to talk about their various businesses and outings and that sort of thing. I think my favorite of all of them that we have listed here was the Urban Ecology Center has a great kind of DIY approach to it. A simple membership for the year gets you access to their kayaks and canoes. You can take them out on just about any body of water. A really great price for that membership. And then even during the winter, you can get out for their snowshoe excursions and that sort of thing. But there's a ton of them that you can choose from.
And kayaking the rivers that run through town is a pastime that is apparently really taking off.
It seems relatively new here. I don't know if people were afraid to get in the water previously, but we also wrote about the Milwaukee Kayak Company. They're coming up on their sophomore season here, second year in existence in Milwaukee.
And they grew really fast last year.
It seems like they were everywhere towards the end. A lot of people were spotting them on the river and thought that that's a great idea. There's a lot of bars and restaurants now that will cater to this type of clientele. So you can just paddle right up and have a beverage before you got to head back.
You know, it makes sense because Milwaukee's actually been getting more and more attention for the health of its waterways, which is kind of weird when you think about it, when you remember just how bad they were. But
right, I imagine there are some old timers who would think about the idea of kayaking the Milwaukee River 25 years ago and say you're nuts.
Yeah, because you could probably just walk across it, right, on all the garbage that was floating in the middle of it. But no, now, I mean, the cleanup efforts and, you know, that goes to groups like the River Keepers and the Friends of the Rivers. It's really paid off because it's not just people around here that are noticing, but it's national groups, national publications that are noticing, and they're really pegging Milwaukee as one of the more underrated cities when it comes to its riverways, its river recreation, its lake recreation, things of that nature.
Well, and one of the things that I had not realized is that there are actually 25 miles of urban water trail that you can navigate.
Yeah, and somebody has mapped out a route that you could follow and hit all of that coastline there.
And let me ask you, I'll put you on the spot here. Is this a pastime that you have enjoyed?
I've done it once or twice here. Once, I think, here. We tried to get into it when we were living in Chicago and to speak to the health of the rivers there. At the time, my wife was pregnant, and they said that's kind of a no-no to get on the Chicago River. But here, it's like Howie said, much healthier waterway that we can get out and enjoy the activities there.
Of course, if kayaking sounds too energetic, there are plenty of ways to sit back and let someone else show you the rivers.
Exactly. And I think just about every one of your listeners has seen these boats out on the river. Another one of my favorites was the Milwaukee Boat Line. We'll have the Iroquois. We put it as they're going to kind of rework the definition of yacht rock because they'll be having bands out there and another great opportunity to sip some beverages and have somebody else do the work for you.
You also reference, I think it's the Edelweiss people. They do some other themes. They do a murder mystery and even a Pirates of the Caribbean.
Pirates of the Caribbean. It just seems like they started this on a lark. The owner, maybe on a dare, was going to go out as Captain Jack Sparrow. And just on a dare, he dressed up and had the boat decorated much like you would see in the Disney film. And now they've made it a regular occurrence over the summer. And it's great for kids' birthdays or just a kid's outing and that sort of thing.
What about for people who would think the river is a little too confining? Can you take a cruise on the lake?
Oh, absolutely. There's a number of outfits that will take you out. If you want to get back to a little bit more participatory, the Milwaukee Community Sailing Center is a great organization that will let you take their boats out on the lake. Sea Dog Sailing, Adventure Charter Boats, that just goes on and on for boat captains that are willing to take you out on the water.
And then if you want to hearken back to the 1800s, there's always the Dennis Sullivan, the flagship of Wisconsin. I did a piece on Tiffany Crywan, the captain, senior captain, I should say, because there are actually two of them. But she's the senior captain. And they have, I believe it's hour-and-a-half day cruises. They do nighttime cruises. They have a lot of educational things that go on board. Or if you just want to go out for a cruise and lift one of the 1,000-pound sails, you can do that as well. But it's a neat thing. When I was talking to her, she was mentioning just how fortunate Wisconsin is to have a tall sailing ship because they're just not around much anymore. And what she said fascinated her about the tall ships is whenever she goes out, she thinks about how, you know, you're going 5-6 miles an hour. And that's the speed at which the world was discovered. The speed at which we, you know, went across the globe. And now you think how slow that is, and people are upset if their app on their phone doesn't download quick enough. But that was the speed of life back then and the top speed of life back then. And it really is a contrast between the past and the present.
And Tim McCormick, you mentioned the Milwaukee Community Sailing Center. This is a place where you can also go to learn how to sail, right?
Absolutely, yeah. There again, it's a yearly membership you would buy into. And they've got classes, I think, starting for as young as 8 years old, you can get on a boat and kind of get your sea legs settled.
Now, Howie Magner, you investigated another water-related activity, fishing. Who were your experts that you turned to for that?
Are you familiar with a man by the name of John Gillespie?
I am familiar with him by name anyway.
Yes. A lot of people probably know him or remember him from his days on TV. He was a very well-known sports broadcaster. His father was the play-by-play man for the old Milwaukee Braves. So the name is pretty familiar in local circles. But he kind of embarked on a second career about 20 years ago and became an expert fisherman on TV. He's now got a TV show called John Gillespie's Water and Woods. Or is it Woods and Water?
Water and Woods.
Water and Woods. Thank you, Tim. I appreciate you keeping me straight. But he's done thousands of fishing expeditions with guides, and what really attracts people to his show is just the excitement level that he brings to it. He's just this really joyful, gregarious man who is part cheerleader, part guide whenever you see him on TV. So I had a nice conversation with him about fishing Lake Michigan, and he couldn't stop talking about how blessed Milwaukee is to have this almost hidden gem of a fishery right next door to us. And you're looking at world-class brown trout fishing. You got salmon fishing, king and coho, rainbow trout. The list goes on.
And I was amazed that even the guides say you don't necessarily even need to go well out onto the lake to catch these.
That's the thing. Half of them say you don't even need to know what you're doing if you go at the right time of year. If you go early in the fall when the salmon are running, you can basically drop a line on shore or near shore in the harbor from a pier, and chances are pretty good you'll end up with a salmon on the end of it. So, but you know, it depends on what level of investment you want to do. You know, you could certainly hire a guide or a yacht or anything of that nature and go out and let them do all the work and let them take you to the hot spots and things like that. But one of the things that makes Milwaukee and Lake Michigan such a great fishery is that you don't have to do that. You can do that, but you can also have plenty of fun and plenty of success just fishing from the shore. And not really having to know what you're doing while you're tossing the line into the water. You go to a bait shop, you grab some tackle and some bait, you ask them what's biting and where. They'll point you in the direction, and you drop a line, and you've got dinner before you know it.
And in fact, the picture that accompanies this feature is of somebody at McKinley Marina doing the fishing right from the dock.
Yeah, it wasn't me, but no, I'm sure they caught something by the end of it too.
Well, we should mention a couple other aspects to this article. Neither of you wrote either of these, but there is a guide to beaches in the area as far south as Racine, actually.
Indeed, yeah. I think that's the kid-friendly option that we speak about here. Kids Cove, it's got a little play structure that's right there on the beach. Claire Hannon did a wonderful job with our beach bodies story here. She also talks about, of course, Bradford. I think, again, every one of your listeners here has seen or visited Bradford. It seems to be the epicenter of Milwaukee during the summer.
Tim, you're a big beach volleyball guy down there during the summer, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely. I thought so. Absolutely.
And also Matt Rohde wrote about wrote a guide to pools in the area, including which ones draw the most people, which ones are the largest, and which ones fit the most people in them.
Yeah, the busiest would be the Tosa Pool, but if you really wanted to get 1,717 of your friends together, they could all fit into Sheridan Pool.
Well, great. Great stuff, and hopefully it will remain warm enough for all of us to take advantage of it. Tim, Howie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mick.
Thanks again for having us.
Tim McCormick is managing editor, and Howie Magner is senior editor of Milwaukee Magazine. The Milwaukee by Water feature is part of the magazine's City Guide issue, which is just hitting the newsstands this week. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Coming up next, the Museum of Wisconsin Art looks back at a tough time in American history with a remarkable handicraft project that sprang up during the Great Depression. That comes along next when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Great Depression was among America's darkest hours. The 1930s were a time of desperate economic circumstances for people from all walks of life. In Milwaukee, more than 40% of wage earners lost their jobs between 1929 and 1933. But it was also during this time that the federal government found some remarkable ways to put people to work, and one of them right here in southeastern Wisconsin. The Milwaukee Handicraft Project used the vision of women artists and employed thousands of people in making wooden and cloth articles. That project is seeing new life in an exhibit that opened in April at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Graham Reed is the director of collections there, and Dr. Charles Waisbrunn is the collector of many of the objects in the exhibit. We first spoke in early April, and Reed told me then about the Depression-era project itself.
The concept that you would have a relief program that employed people, predominantly women, who were essentially deemed almost unemployable, to bring them into a program that made such remarkable things based on aesthetics, design, and education, and that these products would be dispersed not just within the city or within the state, but actually nationally to taxpayer-supported institutions, schools, libraries, hospitals, orphanages, that really fulfilled a need, not just for the people who received these products, but they were absolutely essential for the people who made the products as well, because these products really gave these people a sense of purpose, a sense of pride. It gave them ownership of something. It also gave them a paycheck.
Well, it sounds like it follows the WPA model where you're bringing people in, you are creating things for basically an unemployed workforce. But as you say, what makes this unique is that this was specifically aimed toward women and it was integrated. And it was integrated in 1935 in Milwaukee when that just wasn't done.
Yeah, I mean, they went to Elsa Ulbricht, who was really the champion and leader of the whole project. And they actually asked her, would you take African-American black workers? And she said, because a lot of the other programs wouldn't. And she said, yes. 250 showed up on the first day in November 1935. By the end of the week, there was about 900 people coming to this program because they had heard that there were jobs available for them.
Well, Charles, how did you first learn about this and then become a collector of these objects?
Basically, I was interested in the WPA and the Federal Art Project as a whole, because I thought they really developed wonderful works of art. And again, most people are familiar with the big murals that they did in post offices and a lot of the paintings and the prints. And I think really what drew me to the WPA works is I felt it was really true American art. So here were artists who weren't really constrained by what would sell. They could really do what they wanted to do. And they were paid a weekly stipend for creating works of art. So I don't think they were really under the constraints that a lot of other artists had to do in that they were trying to sell works. Again, the works they produced really showed the American scene and really showed what they were feeling during these real hard times. And I was sort of drawn to that look. And when I moved from New York to Milwaukee, I learned about the Milwaukee Handicraft Program. And again, I think what's so amazing about the Milwaukee Handicraft Program is when they first started, you know, the initial idea was for them to cut out wallpaper objects and make scrapbooks for inmates in the county institutions. And Elsa Albright said, no, that would not be of interest to me at all. And so instead of just doing busy work, they really created wonderful works of art. That's what I liked about it.
Let's talk about Elsa. Who was she and why was she the person that the WPA went to say, can you start this project?
They went to the Milwaukee Teachers College and had this idea of cutting out the wallpaper. And Elsa Albright was the fine arts director at what was really become UWM now. And so they went to her because she was going to develop this handicraft project. And they dealt with handicrafts because they felt this is what unemployed women could do. You know, they could do, they could do scrapbooks.
And they could stitch something.
They were just going to cut out stuff. And she said, no, that's not what she was interested in at all. And she declined. And then when they came back to her, she said, okay, well, I want to hire people who I've taught. And they could be the program directors and they could organize the women workers to do, you know, fine works of art.
When Elsa kind of decided to take this project on, she looked around for qualified, experienced designers and craftsmen, but most of them had jobs or were already on other programs. And so she actually ended up going to her students, many of whom who could not find jobs during the middle of the Depression, and they became the designer foremen. So this was not Elsa and a whole group of, you know, highly qualified instructors and craftsmen who actually did this program. These were basically young people in their early mid-20s who were designing these objects, making the prototypes, and then basically teaching the workforce how to make them.
So those 900 people showed up at the end of like the second day that this was announced. Did they come with any skills at all? I mean, other than, say, basic sewing skills to be able to mend clothing?
They really
or anything?
Didn't even have basic sewing skills. Okay. They were considered really unskilled.
Some of these women didn't know how to what end of a pair of scissors to hold. They were actually a very nervous and scared group of women who showed up because they didn't really know. They were just sent to the address and they showed up and they were kind of, we don't know what we're going to do. We don't know what we're, you know, we haven't had a job for years, maybe not had a job ever. And so there was a great deal of apprehension on that first couple of days.
So what were the first things that Elsa had them do then?
See, it was interesting. For instance, the way it really set up is, for instance, Elsa for the doll program, she took a prize student, Mary Jane Kellogg, who was still in school and made her head of the doll making program. So her job was really to set up these women to help create the dolls. But it wasn't just throwing them in. She went and got a very, very known professional doll maker to sort of help design the doll. And so they'd had the design, and then they taught the students how to either, you know, cut fabric for the clothing or to press fabric to make the head, the mold for the dolls. They taught them everything. They did other projects. You know, they did dolls, they did toys, they did costumes, they did bookbinding, they did textile printing, all having, as a head of one of the departments, one of the prize students or recently graduated students sort of helped design and help train these workers. All these departments had a real trained, sophisticated, educated person sort of leading the trips.
How long did it take to get this up and running as a business?
I mean, it started in November 1935, and really by 1936 they were up and running. And You know, the textile printing was one of the first things, but then they moved into theater costumes, furniture. They did a lot of, in fact, they actually almost got to the point where they were doing an interior design service where they would do desks and tables and chairs and wall hangings and rugs. So for schools, universities, hospitals, if they wanted to refurbish their offices and common areas, they would. And it was a great deal because basically the institution only paid the cost of materials because the labor costs were basically paid through the federal.
Okay, so the WPA paid
that. Basically, yeah, the WPA paid that, but basically the purchasing institution paid the cost of materials, which in most cases was literally cents. Less than there's only a few. Furniture aside. But most of the other things, I mean, the most expensive doll was, what, $2.25?
Yeah. Now, interesting enough, though, these were really not available to the general public.
Okay.
So they had to be tax-supported institutions. So let's say a nursery school teacher would say, hey, it would be nice to have something in my classroom. And so the school would go pay the $2.25, which is also an interesting point is who owns all this stuff. And that's become a much, much bigger issue, obviously, with the fine arts, with the prints and the oil paintings and things like that. And that the government still says they own it and it's – you know, they don't really want that bought and sold on the private market. The handicraft items, the federal government doesn't really go after and doesn't really claim ownership, although in reality – it probably is still owned by the individual schools and institutions.
I was going to say technically whoever purchased it, you know, if they're still in existence, you know.
And many of them are not. The biggest take-home message to the whole Milwaukee Handicraft Project is the quality of work. And if you come to see the exhibit, you're going to see just wonderful wall hangings, wonderful block prints, wonderful dolls. You know, just the work is just fantastic. I know in the doll program, Helen Clark was in charge of the doll program. She really insisted on quality work. So the stitching of the clothing had to be perfect. Otherwise, it wasn't accepted. Everything had to be perfect. They ran a very tight ship.
And I was looking at some of those. Graham pulled out a couple for me when I was up last week, mm-hmm. and I was looking at the stitching, and I was looking at the buttonholes that were made and everything, and it's beautiful, beautiful
yes.
work.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I was reading an interview, a transcription of an interview with Elsa Olbricht, and apparently some of the ladies who worked on the program who were making the doll clothes actually basically took the patterns, took them home, and then upscaled them to make clothes for their own children. So it's kind of a nice reversal. It's not like we're taking adult clothes and shrinking them down to doll size. They were taking doll size clothes and enlarging them to fit their children because the designs were so good.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew how to make them. They knew how these things went together because they'd basically made miniature versions of them.
Are there still any women living in Milwaukee that we know of that were part of this program?
About 10 years ago, I think at the public library, they had some of the people who designed the toys were alive and talked about it. I don't know if anyone is still alive.
I doubt it.
They would be pretty old at
this point.
One
of the things that just as a consequence of the people who got employed by the Handicraft Project, it tended to skew fairly old right from the get-go. So these were women in their 40s, 50s, even 60s or older.
But there must be relatives and people who are descended from some of these women.
Yes. I knew a lady for many years, Betty Sullivan, whose mom worked on the program. And they had pictures of her playing with the dolls. And she was very active in collecting the WPA dolls and the programs themselves. And I think she donated all her stuff to the museum here in Milwaukee. And so she had a connection because her mom was mm-hmm. very active in it. And I know that Henry Sinodal was an artist a lot with the program. And someone I know from New York has been in contact with his son and talked about the program. So he lives here in Milwaukee as well.
So obviously this program was well known at the time in Milwaukee.
It was known nationally. It was known as the project that made Milwaukee famous. It was a kind of play on the whole mm-hmm. beer thing. But it was known as the project that made Milwaukee famous.
And so did other cities take it as a model to use
I think they tried, but nobody came close to replicating
it. No one did come close. I mean, Michigan State Teachers College had a handicraft program. Indiana had a handicraft program. Missouri had a handicraft program. Ohio had handicraft programs. But none of them really had the sophistication that Milwaukee did. There was more just as far as the doll programs, they made foreign dolls to sort of show the dresses of foreign countries. Nothing with the originality and the wonderful workmanship that Milwaukee had.
I don't think you can ever underestimate the importance of Elsa Olbricht. I mean, she really just drove this thing, her passion, her commitment to it. I mean, I don't think this thing would have been anywhere near as successful without Elsa. I mean, she fought in 1942-43 as war production was taking over and the program was essentially becoming redundant. I mean, she fought to keep this thing going. And they just kind of said, look, we can't keep this thing going. We've got war production. And, you know, this is not – this program is really not needed anymore.
So, Charles, I'm going to put you on the spot for a moment. I know you collect a lot of this, and a lot of what is on view here is from your collection. Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? I like the wall hangings the best. I just think the workmanship is wonderful. And I kid aside, I have a large doll collection, and my children are absolutely aghast that I have dolls. And they don't understand it. I think the dolls are wonderful, though. You know, and I always have to, after I say that, I have to say, you know, I coach basketball and I play tennis and I'm, you know.
But I have dolls.
But I have dolls. So
and what's neat is in the exhibition, not only are we going to have quite a number of the dolls, but we actually have one of the original molds that the head was made from and the original paper pattern that the doll, the 22-inch doll, which was kind of the benchmark, it was kind of the ultimate doll that was made by the program. We have a set of the paper patterns and we have a head mold, and then we'll have kind of quote-unquote a naked doll. So if there's any doll aficionados who are listening, you will really be able to see how these things were kind of made.
And the design that went into
them. And the design
them.
Of how yeah. they were constructed, yeah.
The toys were wonderful, too. So they had boy toys as well as girl toys. You know,
yeah.
the toys are fantastic.
Oh, too, yeah. I saw some of the little trains and some of the trucks.
The toys
and
are fantastic.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And again, they have a wonderful look, and the toys are absolutely fantastic as well.
Well, Charles and Graham, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about the exhibition and for your enthusiasm for bringing it to light. Because, like I said, this is something I knew nothing about, and I am thrilled to know what happened right here.
Thank you.
Well, thanks
much.
For having us.
Thanks, Bonnie.
The exhibit Handmade for Hard Times, the Milwaukee Handicraft Project, runs at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend through June 15th. Graham Reed is the director of collections at the museum. Charles Waisbrunn is a collector of Milwaukee Handicraft Project objects, and he loaned many of them to the museum for the exhibit. We first spoke with them in early April. We'll take one last break and then meet up-and-coming Milwaukee photographer Valen Gillette. Lake Effect returns with that conversation right after this on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee is home to many good photographers, ranging from the strictly amateur to the internationally renowned. And while he hasn't quite gotten to that second category, Valen Gillette is well on his way. His commercial work has already been used by a number of businesses in town, and his fine art photography has gotten a great deal of attention as well. It's not too bad for a guy barely into his 20s and self-taught to boot. Valen joins me in the studio now. Valen, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
How did you get interested in photography? What was it about the medium that attracted you?
I liked how it can convey thoughts, but just by seeing it.
Thoughts. Interesting.
It's for me, it's more of a visual response to how I see things. It's totally different. In my everyday life, I find that the most simplest thing can be beautiful, and I try to make the most of that.
But why photography rather than, say, painting or drawing or something else?
For me, it was the most thought-provoking thing. It kind of drew me in. Famous photographers that I knew, like Ansel Adams, when I saw his work, I said, wow, that's what I want to do. I saw that, and it just took a hold of me, and ever since then, photography has been it. That's me.
But you never took a class, is that correct?
That is correct.
So this is all a self-taught journey.
Yes, it is. I've actually dived into books. I would spend 2 to 3 hours just looking over material, how to do this, aperture and f-stops. And I just kind of took that to heart. And every day it's a practice, it's a craft. You have to learn it and go forth and just do it.
Did you start with film or did you always start with digital?
It started as digital for me.
But some of those things still apply.
You
still have to know about aperture and f-stops and all those things.
Yes, correct.
And so as you started to learn and you went out and took the photographs and started using Milwaukee pretty much as your canvas,
yes.
What were you finding out? Were you able really quickly to put thoughts into your photographs, or was it really kind of a ramp-up time?
It was really a ramp-up time. I would walk around Milwaukee and I noticed things that, you know, most people wouldn't see. I looked through Milwaukee photos and I just kind of wanted to point out something very special about Milwaukee.
You know, when you first started and you were learning the craft, as you say, you know, you have to practice that. You have to get the technical skills together. Right. Were you finding that it took a while to be able to produce the photographs that you really saw in your mind's eye? Or were you able to do it pretty quickly?
It was kind of both.
Yeah.
You could kind of say the first photograph I took of Milwaukee, it was a complete failure. And I kind of went back to that old work and kind of figure out what I really wanted to portray.
What was the failure in your eye? What was wrong with that first photograph?
The composition wasn't working for me. I found out that, you know, some of the lights at this, like, there's a certain time where you photograph a certain, say, cityscape just to make it glisten. And that first photograph, it just wasn't cutting it. There was that and much more worse things wrong with it everybody said it looked fine to them, but it didn't look fine to me.
So you hadn't quite gotten to be able to do what you saw.
Right, in my head.
Right.
Yes, correct.
I think that's true for most artists, you know, that, you know, you see what's there, but getting it onto paper or onto canvas or, you know, whatever the medium is always the struggle. For you, since you are self-taught and you are constantly teaching yourself these techniques, how is it going? How many years has it been now since that first photograph and now?
It's been around, I want to say, 6 years.
So obviously things have changed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Things have
and
changed.
Are you happier with getting what you see onto your paper?
Yes. It has been amazing. Ever since then, it has been, for me, changing how I see things around, you know, around me. Photos that I produce now is much more cleaner, much more stronger than I think. And it's just, I see Milwaukeeans use my work. They post it on their social media. And it makes me happy to see people's joy, you know. Even people that leave the States, leave Wisconsin, they say, wow, I miss this place again.
Because of your photographs.
Because of my photographs.
So what is it that you see in Milwaukee that you think other people aren't seeing?
Some people might think it's dirty. Some people think it doesn't have a place. And that's what I aim to do, is make its place known.
You're working in digital photography. And, you know, the world has changed so much in terms of how quickly pictures can go around the world.
Right.
Are you finding that you're making a living doing this? Are people purchasing your images? Are you able to sell your work?
Yes. I've actually sold to magazines, and it's been amazing. Like, I've one or two, three a month, and it's been good.
And so you're actually supporting yourself with this?
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
A lot of artists don't get to do that.
Yeah. It's crazy because my first major breakthrough – this is 3 years ago, was a major coffee company around the world. And that was really amazing for them to ask me to create two pieces of art for them. You know, I've got approached by Northwestern Mutual. There are two photos, Milwaukee photos, that are locked up in their huge safe. So if anything happens to the city, they'll be there. Other things like from local companies like Uber, that's going around now. I've done some things for them blog-wise. I've shot menus for restaurants around town. And my recent commercial work has been Hotel Metro, which is creating photos for their new website. So all around, like, Milwaukee's given back. Everyone's seen my work, and it's been a pleasure.
One of the things I so like about the photographs of yours that I've seen is that you mentioned Ansel Adams at the beginning of this interview.
Yes.
And I can see his influence because you go in for that black and white and that really that depth of feel, that just blackest of the black, you know, and the contrasts between. And it makes the city – it adds to me – a layer to the city that we don't normally see on a day-by-day basis. And obviously other people are responding to your work in the same way.
Right. Social media is one of the craziest things because words gets around. People – I get emails per day, you know, even 6 to 7 emails asking me, like, where could I get this? You know, where can, you know, I buy this? This is amazing, Valen. Like, you need to – make postcards and things like that nature. And yeah, I guess you could say I want people to, you know, look at my photos and feel like this is a city I want to live in. This is Milwaukee. So,
well, I think you've achieved that so far.
Thank you.
How are you thinking about increasing the business? Because you've obviously set up a brand. Right. You know, you are Valen AG, and people are responding to it. People are purchasing your work. Are you thinking of expanding out, or is Milwaukee really the canvas that you want to explore?
I'd like to actually just travel, go around traveling and shooting. And I guess, like you said, I do want to expand, maybe to parts of Chicago, maybe go out in Los Angeles and shoot around a bit. But my focus point will be it's centered here because this is where I started, where it all started. I can't deny that, you know.
Is Milwaukee the thing that you're probably going to want to most explore, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I definitely would like to explore more. I do want to create more pieces for Milwaukee, some more amazing, much more depth pieces. I want to work on a street-themed for my next project, a street-themed series.
Any streets in particular you have in mind?
Wisconsin Avenue.
Okay. Try to see it in a different way.
Right.
Have you thought about taking courses at this point or mentoring yourself to someone? Or do you really feel that going your own way, the way you started, is the way to go for you?
For me, I think for me as an artist, I'd love to explore on my own terms. It works well for me. In the future, I might take courses. Personally, as for myself, it's more of a hands-on experience. If you don't, I guess, just keep working. And if you fail, just pick yourself back up and try it again. That's me. But will I continue on trying to, like, get better? Yes, I definitely will. Even if that means taking courses, yes, I will.
Well, you know, Valen, I can't thank you enough for coming in, and I'm so glad I discovered your photography because I'm not from here, but I've been here about 8 years, and it's gotten me to look at Milwaukee in a little different way, just seeing your photographs. So I'm really pleased that you were able to come in today.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Valen Gillette is a self-taught Milwaukee-based photographer. You can see some examples of his work online at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Most colleges and universities will have seen commencement come and gone. Now high schools will send their graduates off into the world. Political satirist and Lake Effect contributor Will Durst has some words of wisdom in case anyone should actually ask him to deliver a commencement address.
Will Durst here to say congratulations to all you new graduates out there and welcome to the real world. You'll find it surprisingly similar to the environment you just left behind, only different. For one thing, less keggers, unless you're headed for investment banking. Obviously, most of the advice you've gotten so far is as predictable as Nat King Cole in the elevator while Christmas shopping at Macy's. Typical cliches, winners never quit, and quitters never win, and get up one more time then they knock you down, and nose and toes the same way goes, blah blah, hootie-doo. Unrealistic, optimistic balderdash. What you really need at this time is some advice guaranteed to cut through all the sophomoric platitudes. And you've come to the right place, because here they are, 9 pieces of real-world advice for today's grads. Might not be what you want to hear, but guaranteed to help. Their number one thing to remember is the 5-second rule does not apply to ballparks, bus stations, or hospital waiting rooms. Think of getting tattoos like feeding gremlins, not to be done after midnight. No matter what you see on TV, overturned wooden tables are not adequate protection from assault weapons. You can't fix stupid. Gambling is a tax on people bad at math. Everyone is ditchable. Never trust anybody who says, at the end of the day, because at the end of the day, it gets dark. When they ask your name at Starbucks, tell them, Peter Pan. And finally, when someone says, this is not about money, you can rest assured, it's all about money. For Lake Effect, I'm Will Durst.
Lake Effect contributor Will Durst is a writer, comedian, political satirist, and Milwaukee area native. He now lives in California's Bay Area. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.